Next case of the morning is number 012260, Bobby Walter against Irvin J. Brunn. Mr. Malone.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Malone and I represent the defendant appellants in the matter which is on appeal from the district court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. It is the position of the appellants in this case following the jury trial which occurred in October of 2000 that the quantum of proof, the amount of proof that was put in by the plaintiffs in this case was insufficient on the subject of causation. Ms. Walter, the plaintiff in this case, has breast cancer. There was an allegation that there was a delay in diagnosis, and there was an allegation that the delay in diagnosis was a cause of injury to her, although the specific nature of that injury was unclear not specified in the course of the testimony, we believe. We believe that both the quantum of proof put in by plaintiff and the trial court in this case applied the wrong Wisconsin standard in reviewing the expert testimony on causation. And as a result, the determination was made based upon a wrong standard, an inappropriate standard. That would be the standard that was articulated about 11 or 12 years ago in a case called Ellinger before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but it was subsequently modified and changed and clarified in a case called Fisher versus Ganju.
And, now you admit that under the Ellinger burden of production, you admit that that was met here.
I do. That was met in the testimony. That's correct. It's a failure to diagnose case, and that's correct.
Well, under Fisher, isn't that also an acknowledgement that enough evidence existed for a jury to reasonably infer causation?
No, Your Honor. The Ellinger case was dealt only with the issue of the motion to dismiss at the end of the plaintiff's case, which was clarified in the Fisher versus Ganju decision 2 years later. The Ellinger case seems to have been a fact-specific circumstance intended to apply to that particular set of circumstances involving a twin birth and the difficulty of attempting to prove an injury. But the court determined at that time, and it's clarified in the Wisconsin Supreme Court clarified in 1992, was that the burden of proof had not changed, had not been modified. It's a peculiar set of circumstances, but the Ellinger standard in Wisconsin only applies, it is our belief, to a determination on a Rule 50 motion or a motion to dismiss at the end of the plaintiff's case. It has no part in a determination by the trial court following the presentation of all of the evidence from both sides, nor does it have any application to the analysis that needs to be done following the rendering of a verdict.
Well, tell me where I'm wrong. Fisher stated that the three-part burden of production test in Ellinger establishes, and now I want to quote, the minimum quantity of evidence which must be produced from which a jury reasonably could infer that the negligence was a substantial factor in producing the injury. Now, you've admitted that the burden of production was met here, but you argue at the same time that there was insufficient evidence from which a reasonable jury could infer that negligence was a substantial factor in producing the injury. And to me, that seems to be inconsistent with the statement in Fisher. I mean, in other words, the result might be different if the evidence at trial was so overwhelming as to negate the evidence which had met the burden of production, which would have, you know, which might have left insufficient evidence for a jury to reasonably infer causation. And is that what you think is happening here?
No, the burden of production is a term of art as defined in the Fisher case. It means only what is necessary to survive a motion at the end of the plaintiff's case. The court goes on to clarify in this rather difficult analysis, and it says burden of persuasion is something else. That burden of persuasion is really what is the determining factor at the end of the presentation of all of the evidence or on an examination following by the court, an examination following the verdict of a jury. It is our position in this case that the trial court inappropriately looked at the Ellinger case to determine whether or not this case could be submitted to the jury. And keep in mind, it is our position, and frankly in the plaintiff's brief in this case, they say they met this burden of the Ellinger case. And that burden only requires that in a failure to diagnose circumstance, that the plaintiff produce evidence that there was a failure of diagnosis, that the plaintiff would have submitted to the treatment, and that treatment could have made a difference or could have affected outcome or could have caused an injury to the plaintiff. Could is the operative word here. Ordinarily, could, in every other context in the quantum of proof that is required, would be insufficient because could equals possibilities or speculation or conjecture. And the scientific level of proof that is required to establish causation requires that expert witnesses knowledgeable in the topic and knowledgeable in the subject come forth and offer that testimony. Here, an examination of the expert witness who was called or expert witnesses who were called simply, they deal mostly with circumstances that have to do with the possibility of this making a difference. They, in fact, specifically refuse to go back and say, we conclude that this cancer began in 1994 or existed in 1994 or was present in 1995, and we refuse to be involved in that analysis. This was simply a broad brush approach to say it is our belief that there was a delay in diagnosis and that because there was a delay in diagnosis, we all know intuitively that with a delay in diagnosis, there could have been that earlier intervention could have made a difference. And that is sufficient in the Ellinger's context. I hope I'm making myself clear, survive the motion to dismiss.
Yep, but it seems to me that essentially you're arguing that the jury was required to believe your witnesses over those of the plaintiff.
No, what we're arguing instead is that the trial court had an obligation at the end of the testimony before submitting the matter to the jury to apply the Fisher standard. In other words, was there a testimony in the record in this case from qualified expert witnesses that said that there was negligence and that the negligence was causal of a specific injury to Mrs. Walter to a reasonable degree of medical probability? That is required, in our judgment, under the Fisher case, to submit the case to the jury.
There were.
Or to take that under consideration or under advisement and then reexamine it after the verdict.
There were some experts who testified, I think, as I recall.
Yeah.
Where did they fall short?
Well, two of the witnesses, one was a family practitioner, and she testified on negligence alone and said, I don't feel comfortable in testifying on causation issues, understandably. Dr. Corlett was a surgeon, and he testified primarily on standard of care and gave some general overall statements and concepts about how in theory, not specifically, but in theory, a delay in diagnosis could have an impact on a patient. Dr. Cosgrove, who is the oncologist, who would be the one that we would ordinarily expect to hear from in this context, who came up from New Orleans and testified in the case, Dr. Cosgrove failed to say that he was aware that there was a delay in diagnosis. He contended that there was a delay in diagnosis, but he failed to say that I know that this cancer existed in a form which was diagnosable during the relevant time frame, 1994, 1995, 1996, and I can tell you, as we frequently see in these settings, I can tell you that that cancer was at a stage, let's say stage one, that would have been amenable to a lumpectomy. And furthermore, I can tell you that based upon the data that we can look at and analyze and scientifically review, the pathology material that's gathered about the patient subsequently, I can tell you that her prognosis would have been significantly better because she wouldn't have had involvement in some lymph nodes and that the size of the breast tumor was different or smaller. The real problem in this case was that the underlying pathology that, from at least this is our view, the underlying pathology that Mrs. Walters had, the breast cancer that she had, is a very unusual type. I don't think there's any dispute about that. She had a type which is known as primarily a lobular carcinoma. It is the type of breast cancer which does not show up on a mammogram. The evidence in the record in this case shows that she had multiple mammograms during the relevant time period, and there wasn't any evidence of any cancer on the mammogram. And furthermore, this type of cancer does not show as a discrete mass. And so under those circumstances, Dr. Cosgrove, as an example, I think in analyzing the type of cancer that she had, knowing that there was the circumstances when it was diagnosed, was uncomfortable. The only inference I can draw is that he was uncomfortable in coming forth with the quantum of testimony that would ordinarily be required, and that would be a medical certainty, a medical probability, and that he was more comfortable in saying that either hypothetically with such a patient this would have made a difference, or he was comfortable in saying, yes, I think under these circumstances it could have made a difference. I think she would have submitted to treatment had there been an earlier diagnosis. And I think if she had submitted to treatment, it's likely to have been effective and that would have improved her prognosis. But those were all couched in my review of the medical, of the testimony in this case and the transcript in this case, to the standard of could. The problem with that is no problem at all as long as you're willing to live with Ellinger and just be willing to survive the motion at the end of the plaintiff's case. But that isn't really what the quantum of proof that is necessary to prove a case and to meet the appropriate burden of persuasion, which really means burden of proof, I think, to me. But that was the distinction that was made in this Fisher case that attempted to clarify the Ellinger circumstance. In other words, the burden of proof was not met in the testimony that was submitted by the plaintiffs in this case. They had an opportunity through several of these witnesses to do so. One of the things that occurred in this case is that Rule 50 motions were brought primarily just procedurally at the end of the plaintiff's case, but we brought Rule 50 motions at the end of the entire testimony, and then we brought motions that after the verdict was brought in this case, and the trial court in this case, in our view, we think that the decision that she rendered both verbally from the bench in response to the Rule 50 motion at the end of the entire case and the motions following the Rule 50B motions following the rendering of the verdict went back to the analysis of the Ellinger case rather than to determine under Wisconsin existing law, and by the way, we have no quarrel with the jury instructions in this case. The jury instructions that were given properly quantified the burden of proof for the so-called burden of persuasion, and that is that the appropriate standard is you need to be able to establish by the greater weight of the credible evidence to a reasonable degree of medical probability that there is a nexus or a sufficient relationship between the alleged delay in diagnosis or the alleged negligence and some injury to the plaintiff in this case.
Let me see if I can get a bottom line. Bottom line, are you saying that the evidence at trial was so overwhelming that it negated the evidence which had met the burden of production?
No, I don't think that the plaintiff failed to meet the burden of proof. They met the burden of production, which the Wisconsin Supreme Court says only applies to a motion at the end of the plaintiff's case. It says in applying the standard of care or the standard with respect to directed verdicts, one needs to look at only the Ellinger standard. but I believe that the plaintiffs failed to put in the amount of proof that is necessary to establish the burden of proof, or using the nomenclature in Fisher, the burden of persuasion. And so I don't, I'm not even looking at the analysis in this case, Judge, to what evidence the defense put in. I think that I understand in the appeal in this case that that is not a significant part of what we're arguing. We don't argue that in our brief at all. We only argue that the level of proof, the expert testimony that was required of the plaintiffs in this case, was insufficient and did not meet the appropriate standards for establishing the burden of proof or the burden of persuasion, whichever terminology you choose. Burden of production, I hope I'm making myself clear, is this nomenclature or phraseology which the Wisconsin Supreme Court came up with, I think, in order to try to reverse its decision in the Ellinger case without entirely doing so. It clarified it. But we are not contending that it is the analysis in this case that is required requires a review of the entire evidence, although I think that that would be very strong in support of the lack of any causation testimony establishing a sufficient nexus between the alleged negligence and an injury to Bobby Walters. And this is a circumstance that is admittedly confusing. It was confusing to the trial court. One of the things that occurred in the circumstances that were presented in this case was that the magistrate she read Ellinger and Fisher to say that this matter needed to be submitted to the jury for its determination based upon what she understood to be the rules applicable to rulings on motions challenging the sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, I think what she did was read the sentence of Fisher that I read earlier, that the minimum quantity of evidence which must be produced from which a jury reasonably could infer that the negligence was a substantial factor in producing the injury. I think that's what she was relying on.
I think that the record in this case reflects that she relied on Ellinger to say that there was sufficient quantity of proof to submit the case to the jury, which I think is incorrect. I believe that the ruling that she made was after the verdict came in. Specifically in this case, she came back and said, in fact, maybe this is even moot because she took our motion under advisement prior to the deliberations of the jury going on. When the jury returned its verdict, she then ruled on the Rule 50 motions, and it's my belief that in doing so, she concluded that the Ellinger standard was the one that she needed to apply, which we believe is incorrect, and as I have said on a number of occasions. It would not be, in our judgment, it would not have been a circumstance at all unusual or atypical to have the plaintiffs submit the sufficient proof from expert witnesses in order to establish the burden of proof, in which case we wouldn't be here if, in fact, that had been submitted and had been properly reviewed.
Well, she certainly did rely on Fisher at page 6 of her memorandum and order.
Is that the Oh, that's the, yes, that is the memorandum and order that was done after the verdict, but not in ruling on the motion, the Rule 50 motion that we made at the end of the presentation of all of the evidence. That's the memorandum that was done in March or April of 2001, about 6 months after the verdict was completed.
She certainly talks about the Rule 50B relief here.
Yes, she does, and she also refers to Ellinger in that memorandum. Yes, thank you. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Rockport.
Please, the Court, Your Honors. David Rappaport on behalf of the plaintiffs below. It was my pleasure to represent Bobby Walter in the trial court, and it is my honor to do so in this court. Your Honors, the comments that I'd like to make go directly to the point just raised by Mr. Malone. The trial judge was not confused in this case by anything. She did hear this argument. She considered it in light of the two governing Wisconsin Supreme Court cases, Fisher and Ehlinger. By no reasonable reading can anyone say that Fisher overruled Ehlinger. Fisher did not overrule Ehlinger. As a matter of fact, the points that the court clarified in Fisher, which was a completely different procedural context, were all discussed in Ehlinger. And a careful reading of these cases shows that in Ehlinger, the court considered how to deal with a very practical problem in cases of medical malpractice where the claim is that certain treatment should have been given earlier and wasn't, and the causation issue revolves around what difference treatment at some point earlier would have made. The court gave careful consideration to all of the issues that are before you now and decided them. In Ehlinger, the court made clear that to make a proof of causation impossible in delayed treatment cases would not be fair, and that without changing Wisconsin law, which required proof of that negligence by a doctor was a substantial cause, without changing that rule and being crystal clear in its language that it did not change that rule, it lowered the burden of production so that juries could decide whether a particular negligent delay in diagnosis and treatment was or was not a substantial cause of the plaintiff's ultimate condition. And this was the essential holding in Ehlinger. Now, Ehlinger went up in the context of a trial court's ruling that the plaintiff did not have enough and the equivalent of summary judgment was entered in favor of the defendants. That went up, the appellate court reversed, the Supreme Court looked at the issue and found that the case should not have been dismissed in the trial court, that it should have proceeded to trial. And the reason was that these three factors, which we'll call the Ehlinger factors, were all met as the defendants in this case. They have agreed now that we have met. Well, the Fisher versus Ganju case presented the next step of the problem. In Fisher, a similar kind of case was involved, the delayed diagnosis, but in Fisher, the issue didn't come up because of a pretrial ruling. The case was tried, and there was a big quarrel over the jury instructions at that trial because the plaintiffs were arguing that the significance of Ehlinger was that the jury instruction should be altered from a substantial cause to a lost chance theory, and that the three Ehlinger factors should actually be given to the jury so as to soften the bar that the plaintiff had to chin, if you will, with the jury. That was what the quarrel was all about in Fisher. The trial judge said no. Ehlinger does not change the law that this plaintiff still must prove a substantial cause to the satisfaction of a jury, and gave the defendants instructions, which were fashioned on form instructions that were used in Wisconsin for many years. That trial judge relied on language in Ehlinger to appropriately reach that conclusion. There were plaintiff's lawyers in Wisconsin that wanted better jury instructions for plaintiffs. There was a committee that studied what the jury's instruction should be before Fisher was decided, and there were many people that agreed that one reading of Ehlinger might be to lower the plaintiff's burden from the point of view of what the jury is told the plaintiff has to prove. But the Supreme Court in Fisher settled that dispute and said no. The meaning of Ehlinger is that the jury gets to decide the issue of causation in cases like this. We're not going to require a plaintiff to prove the impossible. But the ultimate question for the jury to decide is a substantial cause. Ehlinger did not change the law in that respect. Magistrate Judge Gorenz was a very able and competent trial judge in this case. She understood this. We made no argument that we should get a more liberal jury instruction than what was given in Fisher. We accepted the standard instruction on a substantial cause, and we proved it to the satisfaction of the jury. And the reason for that is because the facts in this case overwhelmingly favor the plaintiff. What we have here is a woman, 39 years old, who started self-examining her breasts in high school. She never had a problem or noticed the problem until one day, a week or two before, she came to her doctor and said, "Last Sunday, I felt a lump in my breast." Now, this is a lump that we proved at trial with board-certified oncologists and a board-certified general surgeon from Harvard, a board-certified oncologist, very well qualified. Nobody argued about that this lump was a small cancer that was later found nearly 3 years later when she switched doctors. And when it was later found, it was found huge. And not only was it huge, but it had spread to her lymph nodes. And it was a stage 3B with a 63% probability of recurrence and death from the cancer. These are the facts.
Your opposing counsel argued it was a very unique cancer that was hard to determine.
Yeah, his argument is consistent with some of the evidence at trial, the evidence that he presented, but it's inconsistent with other evidence. He ignores the fact that Dr. Cosgrove testified that this was an average cancer in an average woman. He says it's a lobular cancer, but in fact it was both lobular and intraductal. And this is what the pathology report says. There was nothing so unique about this cancer when you take the evidence as you're required to in the light most, in drawing inferences in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. That was the defense theory at trial. It was a theory well presented and rejected by the jury based on conflicting evidence. Our evidence was that this is a near 3-year delay in the diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer, that during that entire time the breast cancer was growing in this woman, that it should have been surgically removed by September of 1994, that instead it was not surgically removed until May of 1997, that this was due to the negligence of these two doctors. And it's what the most remarkable thing about this, she went for a second opinion in June of 1995 to an Illinois doctor who we had no personal jurisdiction over. We have a claim against the Illinois doctor. The defense, in cross-examining my experts at trial, proved up that there was negligence by a different doctor in June of 95 that also contributed to cause damage to the plaintiff. This is how our general surgeon got drawn into causation at all. They wanted to prove that because the jury in this case found that that other doctor on the second opinion was also negligent, found that these two doctors were 75% at fault, that that doctor was 20% at fault, and that my plaintiff was 5% at fault in causing her own injuries. Those are all part of this, and these defendants have only been held responsible for their proportionate share of the liability for this delayed diagnosis. These doctors were the primary treating physicians during the period of time of treatment.
It sounds like a difficult diagnostic problem, doesn't it?
Difficult?
Yes.
Well,
you've got all of these fine doctors and missing something.
There was something missing. Absolutely, there was something missing because my client felt a lump, and her first doctor didn't even do an examination. But the problem in this case was the mammograms were normal. I mean, I'll give you a very direct answer to that question. The problem was that mammograms were given instead of careful follow-up. And the mammograms were normal, but mammograms miss cancer 10 to 15% of the time. And in the presence of palpable lumps that are not liquid, and there was nothing done to determine whether this was liquid, the standard of care clearly requires follow-up by the doctor. And so Bobby Walter was reassured that she was fine in spite of having a lump because of a mammogram. So are the doctor's errors in this case understandable? They're understandable, but there was overwhelming evidence, and even the defendants have not challenged, that we proved the negligence of these two doctors in failing to diagnose this breast cancer by September of 1994. And the reason they've made no argument about that is because there was substantial proof at trial, including proof by the doctor that made the diagnosis. My client switched doctors because of an insurance problem. The new doctor immediately felt this breast and said, "You're going right to a general surgeon," something that none of the general practice doctors had done for her before this. Sent her immediately, the cancer diagnosis was made. The cancer was found at a huge, and this is the testimony in this trial, cancer was found huge, and the doctor who found it agreed to testify as an expert in this case against the general practice doctors who had missed it before her, because this is a woman that continuously had problems for 3 years with a growing lump in her breast that wasn't removed. And the relatively outrageous contention of the defendants basically here is that a near 3-year negligent delay in diagnosis of a breast cancer makes no difference. Makes no difference. And what they ignore in saying that is that we brought overwhelming evidence at trial that showed that such a delay does make a difference and did in all probability make a difference for this woman. And I'll tell you something, Your Honors, we have more than the could have that the Wisconsin Supreme Court says is enough. In this case, the entire record, and we've outlined it in our brief, goes substantially beyond what could have been. But here's our basic problem. Because of the negligence of these two defendant doctors, my client was not sent for surgery. There was nothing biopsied or put under a microscope. And no doctor can tell you the details of a cancer, what its cells are made of, the precise size of it, whether it's spread to the lymph nodes, unless it is taken out and put under a microscope. So the dilemma that we find ourselves in is we know from the size of the cancer, from the fact that she felt the lump, and by expert opinion that she had breast cancer in June of 94 when she first presented to a doctor with a lump. What can never be known by anybody is exactly the details of that cancer. How many nodes were involved? Were there any nodes involved? Exactly how big was the tumor? What was it made up of at that time? No one can know that because of the negligence of the defendant doctors, because they put nothing under a microscope, because they assumed that she didn't have a problem. And in that assumption, they assumed wrong, and it made a big difference, because early diagnosed breast cancer, my client testified that this lump was about the size of a pea when she found it. That's a centimeter. Early diagnosed breast cancer has an excellent chance of cure, about 80% at stage one. Stage four cancer is the worst that you can have in breast cancer, and that has a very high probability of recurrence and a very high probability of death if there's recurrence. 3B is where this lady was diagnosed. And 3B, according to the testimony, properly treated, and she was properly treated, has a 63% probability of recurrence. We brought to this jury all of the data that we could. The one piece of data that we couldn't bring is what the defendant argues we need to prove the case, which is the equivalent of pathological data about the breast cancer from under a microscope when it should have been diagnosed. And they brought an expert to argue about how they think that the delay makes no difference. And he argues this based on assumptions that few courts have ever accepted. I think it's remarkable that the defendants haven't cited one breast cancer case, even though these are cases are commonly litigated in its brief, and for good reason. I want to make one other point, which is that this whole question of a different standard for reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence to determine whether the case should go to the jury, on the one hand, and when you're reviewing the case after a jury verdict, on the other, has been rejected by this court. It's been rejected by this court in the Mayer versus Gary Partners case, and it's been rejected by this court in the 2M case, which fundamentally, as I read them, say that in ruling on sufficiency of evidence determination under Rule 50, the same standard applies before trial in a summary judgment context during trial in a Rule 50 motion or after a verdict in another Rule 50 motion. And there's been, this circuit hasn't always been of that view. In 1994, the Mayer case was decided on this particular point, and it is, I believe, the most detailed discussion of this standard by this court so far. But in 2M, the argument was being made that a state standard should be applied and that there may be different standards before, during, and after trial. And in 2M, the panel of that court made crystal clear that position was not the law of the circuit, and there was confusion because there are a few decisions around since Mayer from the Seventh Circuit that raised some doubt about it. And what the 2M court had to say was 2M suggests that this court should reconsider its rule that a federal standard applies to Rule 50 sufficiency of evidence determination in diversity cases. We declined the invitation. As recently as 1994 in Mayer versus Gary Partners, the full court had the opportunity to look at this question and squarely decided, quote, to adopt the federal reasonable person standard across the board, pre-trial, mid-trial, post-trial, and on appeal, for evaluating both the merits and the quantum of relief in diversity as well as federal question cases. And it cited the Mayer case and put in a parenthetical that indicating that the opinion had been circulated to all judges in active service under the Seventh Circuit Rule 40F, and that no judge wished to rehear the case in bank. And then in parenthetical really answers it. It says, we are aware that occasional opinions since Mayer, and 2M is 1999 decision, we are aware of occasional opinions since Mayer have used language indicating that they were not applying a federal standard to this question. And as an example, they cite Winger versus Winger, a 1996 case of this court. But then the court concludes, nevertheless, the choice of standard was not dispositive in those cases, and they did not discuss Mayer. For that reason, we do not believe that these decisions cast any doubt on the analysis Mayer set forth at such great length. Getting to the bottom line, I think that the case comes down to a couple of basic points. The arguments of substantive law made by my colleagues who are defending this case are in direct conflict with two controlling precedents from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Fisher and Ehlinger. And we proudly rely on Fisher. If Ehlinger wasn't on the books, Fisher alone would support what the trial judge did in this case and the sufficiency of the evidence from the point of view of substantive Wisconsin law in this diversity case. The second point is that my colleagues have argued for a different standard after the trial than before the trial and clung to that argument during questioning by this court. And that argument flies in the face of Mayer versus Gary Partners and the 2M decision in this court. And so I find myself in a rather unique circumstance. Bobby Walter's breast cancer should have been diagnosed in 1994, not 97. It would have been removed. She would have cooperated with care. We have brought forward people to say that a 3-year or 2 3/4 year delay in diagnosis of breast cancer mattered, that it was a substantial cause of damage to the plaintiff, and that on the basis of excellent experts that they directly took the ultimate issue on. You know, it's not even the could have. They said it made a difference. They explained why it made a difference. Well, so what do we have here? The defense now has agreed that the case was properly tried. No issues have been raised concerning jury selection, the arguments before the jury, the presentation of evidence. Nobody challenged the qualifications of our experts or the basis of the opinions that they offered up. We tried the case, and the defendant now concedes that directed verdict in the defendant's favor at the close of the plaintiff's case in chief would have been inappropriate. The case is given to the jury, argued to the jury. We met our burden of persuasion because the jury that was properly instructed returned a verdict for this plaintiff. And all that's left is our arguments that conflict with the Wisconsin Supreme Court and this court. And for these reasons, Your Honors, this verdict should be affirmed. These rulings should be affirmed. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Rappaport. Mr. Malone? We'll make that as 2 minutes that your colleague went a little bit over.
Thank you. The issue in this appeal is causation and the quantum of proof that was put in on causation. Unfortunately, breast cancer, the evidence is quite clear in the record in this case, can exist for several years. And in addition, breast cancer doesn't always have a good prognosis, even if it is found at an early stage. The determination in this case, however, is what the trial court should have done. If you think about it, the trial court has a gatekeeper function. That gatekeeper function, before submitting a case to a jury, requires that the court determine that there is a sufficiency of evidence on a topic such as causation. Unfortunately, in this case, the court applied a lower standard. The Fisher case specifically says that the production burden drops out of the case and plays and has no role to play after the challenge at the end of the plaintiff's case. It goes on to say the three-part test has nothing to do with plaintiff's burden of persuasion regarding causation. Judge Gorenz, Magistrate Gorenz, gave it a role at the wrong stage in the trial, and that was the problem. insofar as the specific ruling where she did that, it is found at Volume 7 of the transcript at page 1202. This would have been during the course of the trial. In fact, it was immediately after the verdict was in. As far as the Meyer case is concerned and the federal standard, actually the Meyer case says that the federal district court is to apply the appropriate federal standard even if state law would require the judge to submit the identical case to the jury. Well, we submit in this case that even if you were to read Ellinger and Fisher to say that the case should be submitted to the jury, that the federal standard, as articulated by Meyer, would, in fact, require a different result. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rappaport. Mr. Malone, thank you as well. The case will be taken under advisement.